from GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. How do you imagine your retirement might be? Quiet days spent on a sandy beach by the ocean? Maybe traveling around the world? Covered in grandkids watching TV on the couch?
Assuming I have my house and car paid off already. Just, you know, get the taxes, the food. And of course, you know, I'm older. I have all that time on my hands. When I have time, the money just flies away.
No matter what your dreams may be, getting there takes a lot of thought and preparation. And the truth is, most of us are not ready.
I see all these elderly people around me, and they're always worried about money, so it makes me worry about my life. So I'm mostly anxious when it comes to retirement.
Last month, we dedicated a whole hour to talking about aging and the issues that come along with it. How much to save, how to live independently, and how the growing elderly population will affect all of us. We'll revisit those conversations about aging in America today, and we'll talk about the science of growing older, how to properly plan for retirement, and what living options are available further down the road. But we also wanted to know what you thought about this topic, and so we asked you, how do you feel about getting older? Are you confident, nervous, or just unsure about the future? Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Leslie Morris. I live in Macon. I'm going to turn 80 soon, and the last few years have been the happiest of my life. I have enjoyed it a lot. And that is despite the looming health problems, the aches and pains. Yes, they're scary, but I keep up my mobility through strength training, and I live in a retirement community. I have friends, I have activities, I have lots to do, and it's a great time. Don't be afraid of it.
We always love to get your thoughts. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The Emory Healthy Aging Study is one of the largest research projects of its kind. Emory University hopes to enroll 100,000 people in this study and then analyze them over a four-year period. The goal is to better understand the nuances of aging. I spoke with Emory Professor Michelle Marcus about this ambitious project back in May. She's an epidemiologist and a member of the research team. We started off by talking about one very special member of the test group. I understand you've gotten your mom even involved. She's going to be part of the study.
Absolutely.
Was that a rough sell? Did you have to convince her?
Well, actually getting her to figure out how to use her iPad to fill out the questionnaire took a little work, but she's good. She goes on Facebook. She can read emails. So, yeah, she's on it.
So you have to be tech savvy to participate.
Well, it's not difficult. It's actually very easy. Any kind of a smartphone or an iPad or a computer will work.
Okay, so 100,000 people over 4 years, and I just want to list off, I think, so far at least a small number of the teams involved. This involves the neurology department, cardiology, internal medicine, epidemiology, which is your department, biochemistry, immunology, statistics, psychiatry, genetics, radiology. I mean, you guys are doing as complete a scan as possible. How much is this going to cost?
Well, we have a very generous gift from a private donor to get us started, and that will take us through the first 5 years of the research. But and we expect to learn a great deal in the next 5 years, but really the longer the study continues, the more valuable the data that we collect will become, because we're enrolling people when they are relatively healthy in the middle years. Of course, we are also enrolling some younger people and some older people, but our focus is primarily to recruit people in their middle years and then to follow them over time and to determine what distinguishes the people who age well from the people who don't age so well. So, you know, we baby boomers, we don't want to live longer. We want to live better. We want to hold on to our vitality, our intellectual functioning, our physical abilities. And this is a partnership between all of the experts and the general public to discover what makes a difference. We will share everything that we know about what makes a difference. We're interested in what the participants think makes a difference in their lives. And by completing questionnaires periodically about their own medical history, their own current health, we can put these things together and find out what helps you age healthier.
Is the point of it mostly predictors to figure out, say, who's at a higher risk of getting Alzheimer's, who's at a higher risk of getting heart disease? Is that the primary focus?
Yes, but at a much deeper level. So in other words, if we can understand not just, you know, okay, if you have a family history of Alzheimer's, you're at greater risk, but biologically how that operates. Also, for example—
In other words, is it genetic that makes it tied over from the generation before?
Yes, so genetics is definitely a part of it. However, the vast majority of people who get Alzheimer's don't have the genes that we've identified as high-risk genes, just like the vast majority of women who get breast cancer don't have those breast cancer genes that are identified. If you have that gene, yes, you're at a higher risk. But
Most people
who get it don't have it. So what we're trying to understand by involving all of these people who do research on the cellular level is trying to understand what the biological pathway is, how the genes and your environment and your diet interact to produce a particular health outcome. Because once we understand that chain of events, then we can figure out how to interrupt it.
We'd love to hear from all of you out there. How do you feel about getting older? We asked a few people around Metro Atlanta. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Kelly Sanderson. I live in Villa Rica, Georgia. The thing that concerns me the most about aging is the health problems that come along with it and also having enough money to retire comfortably.
Tanaka Makuvaza. I live in Duluth. What freaks me out about getting older is probably loss of mobility. I just wouldn't understand that feeling. I fall in and I can't get up, just to not be physically able to stand up. Just everyday things you can't do anymore, run, play.
My name is Pat Walsh. I live here in Atlanta. I live in Buckhead. I'm generally upbeat, you know. We all get our turn. There was a time I was your age, and there was a time I was younger, leaping high buildings. And then you get a little older, and you do what you can do, and you try to get up every day with a smile if you're half healthy, mentally and otherwise. And I have an older brother who's suffering some early stages of dementia. I suppose that, you know, the longer we live, the greater risk we face of those kind of really disheartening illnesses.
My guest is Emory Professor Michelle Marcus. She's part of this massive research project that will study the process of aging. You know, Michelle, there are so many questions, and so often that when people talk about aging, I seem to be reading sometimes contradictory things from doctors and scientists. You know, some people say an older person needs more sleep. Some people say an older person will need less sleep as they age. Sleeping is part of the research. What do you hope to learn from people's sleep patterns?
Well, sleep patterns are very important, and we do know that it is important, that sleep quality is important, and particularly—
When you say sleep quality, you mean how well, like, are you getting to the REM cycle, or what does sleep quality mean?
Yeah, the REM cycle is part of it, but also a lot of people have sleep apnea, and they don't, and they're not aware
of that. Where they stop breathing for
short periods
of time.
So we know that does increase as you age, and that really disrupts your sleep quality. But we don't really understand how that contributes to poorer health and exactly how that contributes to diseases of aging, to your vascular system and to your brain and your cognitive system. So that's one of the goals of the study. We are asking about sleep quality and about sleep duration. And that's one of the areas that we're exploring along with diet and physical activity and family history.
How do you make sure you have a diversity? Because I imagine that in some cases, race, especially when you're looking at genetics, matters. So you'd need to get a pretty diverse pool.
Well, that's a real advantage of doing this study in Atlanta. Atlanta is an unusually diverse city. And I mean that not just racially and ethnically, but socioeconomically and diet and
even
lifestyle.
Like birth, we have lots of immigrants, people who weren't born in the United States.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's really, Atlanta is really an ideal place to do this study. And it's so important for us to get people of diverse backgrounds to participate, because it's only if these people from diverse backgrounds participate that we'll understand how the factors that affect what factors they have in common with other people, that in spite of their different background, what is it they have in common that helps them age well or have
not.
Or not.
What question? I mean, you guys are going to end up with a huge pool of incredible data that will have to be sifted through, but still just a treasure trove of riches.
Absolutely.
Questions? I mean, what are, say, the top two questions you would like to get answered? You, particularly, Michelle. What questions do you want to get answered?
Well, I'm particularly interested in the role of environmental exposures in our health. Pollution and pesticides and solvents and heavy metals. And we know that many of these things do have adverse effects on our health. And unfortunately, that's another reason that Atlanta is a good place to do this, because, in fact, we have some very bad air pollution. And we do know that air pollution has adverse effects on your lungs and on your cardiovascular system. And we want to see how these things interact and how they might impact your health. Because it's important, because that's something that we can prevent. You know, some biological processes we can learn how to interrupt, but other exposures we can actually reduce. We actually have the power to control those. So I come from a public health perspective, which is really on a population level, where can we do the most good?
So that's your number one question. And how long exactly? This is supposed to be 4 years, but you mentioned 5 years earlier. So how long will the study actually continue?
Well, we hope to continue the study for 20 years or more.
Just keep
following people. Because if you think about it, we're collecting information and biological samples on people at one point in time. And then 10 years from now, somebody develops Alzheimer's disease who didn't have at the time that we collected the sample. We can pull their sample and see
what's changed.
Michelle
Marcus is an epidemiologist at Emory University and a member of the Emory Healthy Aging Study research team. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. One of the trickiest stages of life is the transition into retirement. Many of us have dreams of how we want to spend our golden years, but those dreams might never be realized for many people. One survey found more than half of Americans over 50 do not have any retirement savings to rely on. None. I spoke with two financial experts about how to stay on the path to a successful retirement. This was back in May. Chris Farrell is a senior economic contributor for Marketplace, and Carrie Hannon is the AARP's jobs expert and author of the book, Getting the Job You Want After 50. I started off the conversation by asking Carrie, what exactly does having a comfortable retirement mean?
Good question. I think it's clearly different for everyone, what you want and expect in your retirement years, But truthfully, you know, the point that I make in a lot of my work is that, in fact, you know, part of everyone, I think, most people's retirement moving forward, work is going to be a piece of that. And I think that's become a pillar of our retirement plans. And it's not work as a four-letter word. It's work part-time, seasonal, whatever, to kind of help you get through this period of time and doing work that you enjoy.
Chris, is there an average retirement? Like, can we say this is what retirement looks like for the vast majority of Americans?
I think we can. Now, if you look at the advertising, it's people sitting on the beach, not working, not having anything to do with colleagues. But if you look at the numbers, a majority of Americans who retire have some kind of, just as Carrie, some sort of bridge job, part-time job, do some contract labor. They're not working the 40, the 50, 60 hours a week. And they're not, you know, suffering from being told to do more with less. But they're building a portfolio that is continuing to bring in some income that really sort of helps out. But it also, you know, if you think about work, it's also a social environment, and it kind of keeps your mind engaged. But I would say a majority of people today in their early retirement years are doing some form of work.
And the age has changed, right, Carrie? The average age at which people go into retirement, even if they're working part-time?
I think most people think, you know, it's sort of a tricky question because most people think they're going to work longer than they are going to. They say they plan to work past 65, but often healthcare issues or having to care for a parent or something like that does sort of step them out of that. So I think you need to be careful about saying what the people are traditionally saying. They're retiring later. There's all kinds of different situations. But what we do know is that someone in their 60s can easily have another 15 years to do some kind of work and contribute and have impact and build, you know, income as a safety net. Even people who have sufficient retirement savings and have been good about that, you know, to continue bringing in some income is a safety net for them. So I see a lot of that happening out there, that's sort of reaching, you know, so there's not hard and fast retirement age per se.
But we've also, Chris, I mean, this is not an economic question, but we've also heard that retirement keeps you, working at least a little keeps you healthier for longer. So there can be benefits to keeping a part-time job beyond just bringing in that paycheck.
Well, I think this is one of those growing realizations, because it used to be we'd think, look, the people who are working longer, by definition, were healthier. And now what we're beginning to realize, and the research is really reinforcing, is that working longer, staying engaged, and it's really the engagement what matters, staying engaged, that also helps you stay healthier, because you're in an environment where, I don't know about you, but it seems like you're learning a new computer system every 6 months, and you have to interact with people. And if you think about the workplace, it's a community. There are people you like, there are people you don't like. And one of the things that we have really come to appreciate is probably one of the most dangerous situations for someone as they get older is becoming isolated, is becoming lonely. And it doesn't mean that your best friends are at work, but it keeps you in a social environment. And I think that's one of the real returns to at least staying somewhat engaged in the workforce.
I mean, I feel like even if somebody irritates you, that's still stimulating your brain.
Well, it gets the blood flowing, you know? It just does.
Let me play you this clip. We went out and asked people in Metro Atlanta about their thoughts or fears about retirement. So take a listen to this comment. This is Pat Walsh of Buckhead, and he's trying to figure out what the magic number is.
I have no idea what the number would be now. I'm aware that the consumer price index and the world itself changes dramatically. So the cost of living and the cost of doing things rises. And expectations are higher, I think, among young people today. That would drive their required number up.
Is he correct, Carrie? Has the so-called magic number you need for retirement changed?
You know, I think in a certain respect it has. But you got to remember that, you know, I encourage people, take a look at what you're spending today and do a budget of what your costs are today and figure it's going to be about the same amount in retirement. You don't really have less. Your expenses change. I mean, your medical costs are going to ramp up, but there may be some other things that aren't as much. But a good way to figure it out is sort of look at where you are today, how much you're spending, and factor in a little inflation for each year you think you're, and then the crystal ball, how long are we going to live? So it's really tough, but that's just a way to kind of get a grip. But most importantly, most people never take the time to even run one of those calculators, which they're online, they're easy to do. And even if you just plug in a few things, the ballpark estimate, estimator, I think Chris might have the correct thing on that, is a good, easy one to do. And at least it gets you thinking about saving and thinking about what you might need.
Chris, do you have a good guide that people can go to? Because, look, people get afraid. I think that's probably what prevents a lot of people from looking up what that magic number is, right? They don't want to get the bad news.
Right. So there's a couple things. As far as some, you know, the quick calculator that you just do, you know, it doesn't get into a whole lot of detail. Fidelity has a good one. TIA CREF has a good one. And it's sort of looking at your age and your income and then how much more should you have. To get the more detailed work, analyzenow.com has very good information. And you really want to delve into it, I'd go to ESP Planner, Larry Kotlikoff's, an economist, the planner that he's created. But it's also really important to remember, you know, if you've lived your life wearing a t-shirt and blue jeans, you know, you're going to have one sort of expectation and one pattern of spending. And a lot of times, you know, if you look at the advertising, you hear how much money you need, it's as if everyone lives on a country club. So it really is, I really think Carrie's just hit it just right, is look at what you're spending your money on now. And then a lot of it is sort of the common sense stuff. If you own your own home, which 80% of Americans 65 and older own their own home, you know, pay off that mortgage. Get rid of any credit card debt. Lower your expenses that way. And that will just really help your household financial safety net.
My guests are financial experts Carrie Hannon and Chris Farrell. We're talking about the best ways to prepare for retirement. And as I mentioned, we asked folks around Georgia to tell us how much they think they need to retire comfortably. Here's what they said.
My name is Rebecca Frankson, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia. If I had to put a number on the amount of money that I needed for retirement, I believe our financial advisors told us it was upwards of $1 million, which just seems unattainable at this point.
My name is Alicia Blakely, and I live in Decatur, Georgia. I guess on an annual basis, anywhere from $50,000 to $75,000.
My name is Kelly Sanderson. I live in Villa Rica, Georgia. Price tag on retiring comfortably, you know, I'm honestly not sure. Like, if I had to take a guess, I would say $80,000 to $100,000 maybe, just so I can travel and everything later in life.
$80,000 to $100,000. I imagine, Carrie, your first thought is, wow, was she underpricing that?
Well, it's yes, but that at least she's thinking about it, and that's the most important thing. And the younger you are when you start thinking about this, the better shot you have if you can start socking some away, because it compounds and it grows without you having to worry about it. If you can put it in some retirement accounts, there's some good target age funds that people can invest in that kind of, you can, you know, get it automatically going for you. So the younger you can start, the better, because the numbers do compound and they can get big over time. So I think it, I don't want to be a, you know, squashing that. The fact that she's thinking about it, I think, is really great.
Okay, but the one, when people do think about it, Chris, look, I've been a single parent for most of my adult life, and I just didn't ever feel like there was even a penny left over to put into retirement. And I imagine a lot of people feel that. How do you get past people who are living paycheck to paycheck?
Well, hopefully you're working for an employer that offers you a retirement savings plan at work, which really is the easiest way to save, because then you have a 403B or you have a 401K, and the money, you know, is automatically taken out of your paycheck. And if hopefully there's an employer match, which is, by the way, that's where the real money comes from in a retirement savings plan at work, is through that employer match. And so hopefully you just participate in that retirement savings plan, and it's pre-tax dollars. And what most people find out is they don't really miss the money, because they actually never see it, because most of us spend what comes into our checking account. So that's really the key. So the key is not to worry about your number, how much you need. It's having some sort of savings plan, some sort of, you're just putting a little bit of money away. If that's really hard, you know, and your employer doesn't offer one, there's something to think about called a Roth IRA. Now, with a Roth, is funded with after-tax dollars, but here's the nice thing about a Roth. It's kind of like an emergency savings plan. It's great. It's a great plan for retirement, because when the money you withdraw during retirement is tax-free, but let's say,
because it was taxed on the front end.
It was taxed when you went in, but you hit a rough patch. You can withdraw your contributions with no penalty, and with no tax implications, because you've already paid taxes on it. So it can act as an emergency fund if necessary. But if you don't need it, you have it for your retirement.
Carrie, how much Social Security can the average millennial hope to collect? We know it's not going to be what people in past years have collected that much. I mean, that's what most financial experts tell us. But how much can someone rely on Social Security? Not enough to sustain them, right?
No, I don't think. You know, the program was never designed to be that way. It's really, it's just part of sort of that, we all refer to it as your, sort of your three-legged stool. You know, you have that, you have your retirement savings from an employer plan or a pension, and you have your own personal savings. And now I add that fourth pillar work, which it really provides the whole package for you. So I wouldn't, I personally feel they're going to have Social Security there for them. I think there's nothing to worry about from that perspective, but it's not going to be a huge chunk every month. It's just going to be a piece of what you need to have put aside. And I will add to what Chris said, too. It's important if you think you don't have enough money, like to spare anything to put away, even if you can do a little bit, a lot of employer plans, or you can even do your own automatic taking it out of your paycheck and putting it in an IRA, but you can have an escalation clause, so you start small, and then as you, you know, and then you can ramp that up as you start earning some more or you feel more comfortable.
Chris, one of the issues that affects this, though, is the lack of growth in the average wage in the United States. They have, I'm not talking about CEO level, which has grown explosively, but for the average worker, wages have relatively stagnated, which I imagine is complicating retirement planning for Americans. By how much is it complicating it?
Oh, it's complicating quite a bit because if you just think about it, the pie is not growing that much for the average person, for the typical worker. And if you have kids, sending them to college has gotten more expensive. Your health care bill has gotten more expensive. And so, you know, overall, it's so easy to tell people you need to save more. And one of the reasons why it's so hard for people to save is just as you're mentioning, you know, there hasn't been a lot of wage growth or there is wage stagnation, and that's for real. And the other thing is about almost half of all private sector workers don't have access to an employer-sponsored retirement savings plan at work. And that's really the big disgrace in our
society. Wait, can you just give me that statistic again? Over half of American workers?
No, nearly half of private sector workers do not have access to an employer-sponsored retirement savings plan at work, which is, you know, the employer-sponsored retirement savings plan at work is simply the easiest way to save. And as Carrie was saying, you can start out with small amounts and then you can increase it in time as you get some kind of wage increase, even just if it's just a wage increase that matches inflation. So it's a great way to save. But for a lot of other people, they have to go out and do it on their own. And that's really hard to do. You have to go set up an IRA. You have to go set up a Roth IRA. So that's one of the big problems in our overall system. But here's the thing, you know, it's the only thing that really matters here is that you save and that you keep your debt levels down. And if you do those two things, if you save and you keep your debt levels down and you're entering into those traditional retirement years, you're probably going to be in a decent circumstance. And then if you add a little bit of work in there, that buys you a little bit of time to kind of figure out, okay, where can I cut back on my spending? Maybe get rid of my last little bit of debt. And I think most people are going to be okay.
And yet, Carrie, the very time when a lot of people are able to suddenly start putting money, more money into their retirement, pay off some of their debts, is the time these days when, like myself, I'm 46, and I have to now pay my kids' entire college because the cost of college has shifted from the state to mostly parents now. I mean, we've shifted a lot of costs onto average individuals at the same time that wages are not increasing. Where's the give in this?
You know, I got to say, you know, one thing I caution folks is, yes, parents feel obligated to pay for their colleges, you know, the education for their children. But in fact, if there's anything you can do, it's more important to save for your own retirement than it is to fund your kids' college education. And that, it's not being cold-hearted. The truth is, no one's going to give you a loan for your retirement. And you can, you know, you can probably find some financing for a college education through, there's all, you know, fellowships, through student loans. You just have to just work that market, because I think you're going to be far better off if you can find a way to focus on your own retirement. The kids have a long time to get, and there are many programs out there. So that's just, I mean, that's being a little cold-hearted about it, but I think there is some truth there.
That was Carrie Hannon. She is the AARP's jobs expert and author of the book, Getting the Job You Want After 50. You also heard from Chris Farrell. He's a senior economic contributor for Marketplace.
clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hand played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hand used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might be snakes there in that grass, Grandma.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's on Second Thought. 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day. That's according to research from the Pew Research Center. And the National Council on Aging finds almost all of them have at least one chronic health condition. And that means it's pretty likely someone will eventually have to take care of them. Family caregivers can experience stress that affects their own health. GPB's Gabrielle Ware reports on one facility in Savannah that provides much-needed care for caregivers.
Lenny Doe sports a Yankees hat and jersey with a thick New York accent to match. He self-describes as a people person, but right now his face is somber. He's trying to get his 78-year-old mother with Alzheimer's to use the restroom. Come on, it isn't easy.
You got to go to the bathroom. The bathroom is right there, Mom. Go ahead to the bathroom. Go ahead. Come on. Come on. All right, Mom. I didn't say about the chair. You said you got to go to the bathroom. Come on.
Caring for his mother is not Doe's only struggle. In 1999, he was shot in the head four times. No one expected him to survive. But he did. His mother nursed him back to health. So 4 years ago, when he found out she had Alzheimer's, he wanted to care for her. Later health complications resulted in his regular use of a wheelchair. Doctors think stress from caregiving contributed to his decline in health. Doe isn't sure, but says it doesn't matter.
You can't never repay your parents for nothing, for all that they do for their kids anyway. I just wanted to show them my appreciation.
It's very common for caregivers to neglect their own health. The National Center of Caregiving says the results can be increased levels of stress, depression, and even premature death. Most people will take on caregiving duties at some point in their life, according to a report released by the AARP, but many have little to no training.
It's not like we say as we're going to college, oh yes, and probably another responsibility that I'll have in the future will be caregiving.
That's Paula Hudson. She's the manager of the Adele Institute, which opened late last year. According to officials at its partner, the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving, Adele may be the only institute in the state that provides direct hands-on training to caregivers.
We recognize that, you know, there was definitely a void in the community with regards to helping caregivers.
But if so many are struggling, why not just get professional assistance?
In-home care is very expensive.
And many don't want to put their loved ones in a facility. According to Deborah Haggerty, assistant nursing professor at Armstrong State University and former caregiver.
I was paying $18 an hour for 24-hour care.
That's over $3,000 a week. She didn't qualify for Medicaid, so the costs were split between Haggerty and her mom. Caregiver Lenny Doe is watching his mother's brain deteriorate before his eyes. She's cradling a teddy bear she believes is her child.
And my baby, cutest little thing I ever was.
He says he's stressed every day, but he won't give up.
I'm not a quitter. I don't let nothing stop me or slow me down from doing what I need to do.
Despite his determination, Doe says he still has moments of doubt. The Adele Institute hopes to give caregivers like Doe the tools, training, and support they need to keep caring for their loved ones. For GPB News, I'm Gabrielle Ware in Savannah.
The decision to put a family member into a nursing home is never easy. First of all, they're expensive, and there's also no guarantee your loved one will receive really quality care. According to George Washington University, 1.3 million Americans now live in nursing homes. And on average, those nursing homes cost $83,000 per year. So what other options exist for older Americans? I posed that question to two expert guests on a recent show. Susan Ryan is the senior director of the Greenhouse Project, and Beth Baker is author of the book, With a Little Help from Our Friends, Creating Community as We Grow Older. Susan kicked off the conversation with her thoughts on the current state of senior care in America.
I think our country is in a real quandary with trying to understand what to do with the changing demographics. As you look at the boomer population that is certainly aging, I happen to be one of them. We are certainly looking for what those options are. And as a nurse, I can tell you I did home care and I have done long-term care. And I think the solution, we are really challenged in finding the right solutions. But the Greenhouse Project, in my opinion, has done the greatest job of combining the best of home care, but has it licensed under the regulatory and reimbursement requirements that fit within Medicaid systems and so forth. So it really is like real home, but it is licensed as skilled nursing. So it offers kind of everything you would want in home, but you're able to age in place and at an affordable option.
The Greenhouse Project is the brainchild of a doctor, correct?
That is correct, Dr. Bill Thomas.
And what was his purpose? Because as from what I read, he was looking into more than just cost. He was actually talking about what kind of housing actually keeps an older person healthy.
So you kind of have to go back and take a look at how Dr. Thomas came to the concept. And it was really, you know, his role as a medical director in a nursing home. When he encountered an elder who was living in that nursing home, she had a rash on her arm and he was called in to see the rash. He took a look at the rash and was ready to write an order for that. And she grabbed his arm and said, "I am so lonely." And he realized at that moment that what really afflicted elders in nursing homes were the three plagues of loneliness, helplessness, and boredom. He then embarked on, this was his call to action moment, and he really determined that it needed to be better. And he and his wife, Jude, developed 10 principles called the Eden Alternative, which is now an international movement, to really infuse life and meaning into those sterile environments. But over time, he recognized that those buildings were aging more quickly than those living in them.
Yeah.
And he really was looking for the ideal environment where people could live life with meaning and purpose. And the greenhouse model kind of was birthed out of his exploration of trying to find what will be that ideal place so that elders can, the Eden Alternative principles can live, grow, and thrive. But yeah, elders as well will live, grow, and thrive.
So, Beth, Susan describes this as a quandary that we're in right now. You've described the nursing home situation in the U.S. as a coming disaster, right? Why is this such an issue?
Well, because 99-100% of us dread and fear nursing homes, except for places like the Greenhouse, which I totally support. I've been to several. And what I think people want, no matter their age, no matter their frailty, they want to have a community of folks around them who care about them, and they want as much independence as possible. The Greenhouse provides nursing home care that meets those values. And in my most recent book, I look at grassroots alternatives to create those same conditions of community and independence before we need nursing home level care. There's a lot of research that shows our health and well-being is really directly affected by loneliness and isolation. So I was really curious about what are our options before we really need full-time care.
Yeah.
And I found some really fun and wonderful places around the country. I'm happy to go into.
We are going to go into them. First, let's hear this comment from Alicia Blakely of Decatur. We asked her about her housing plans as she ages.
I thought about, you know, they have what's called a little house nation where people are downsizing and they're getting homes that are affordable, and even young people are doing that right now, you know, so that they can do more travel and not have to work so much. So there's just different things that I've been thinking about in terms of that.
So, Beth and Susan, let's go into some of the alternatives to nursing homes, because not everybody's going to have access to a greenhouse project, and not everyone is able to, say, modify the home they live in to make it usable as they age. So, Beth, what are other some of the other alternatives?
I was really interested in finding places that were relatively affordable, and I was really pleased that there are a lot of them. One exciting alternative I found in California are senior artist colonies. These are apartments that were created by a visionary who wanted to put creativity front and center for us as we grow old, whether we've been lifelong artists or never dabbled in the arts. So it's this wonderful community with studios and theater space and all kinds of classes. It was such a rich environment. People were thriving there. I went to cooperatives, both urban high-rise cooperatives in New York City, where folks had moved in there in the practically the Depression era and were now quite old but didn't want to move, and they had brought a whole lot of services into the co-op to support people in staying as independent as possible, nurses, social workers, all kinds of classes. And I also went to a co-op in rural Oregon that was a mobile home cooperative that was at risk of having the land sold out from under them. They formed a co-op and in the process formed a supportive community. There's really unusual examples around the nation.
Susan, how important is it that you be in a place where there are people your same age around you? I've seen designs that there's in Europe, there are designs where they have college students get cheap rent if they live in some senior communities. And I wonder what the difference is between having a community where there's young people, living in a place where you're living with family members, and living in a place where there are other seniors.
Well, my opinion, and I believe it is the philosophy of Greenhouse, is that the opportunity to engage intergenerationally is really, really important. That's life. And for elders to be segregated, to me, it's just segregation, in my opinion, is never a good idea, but especially our elders. I think elders have incredible wisdom and insights to share with those that are younger than them. And I think both benefit. There's something called reciprocity in relationship building that is essential to really bringing life to people. And so the greenhouse model is all about really creating opportunities for different generational or intergenerational opportunities.
I'd like to jump in and say that all this polling and surveys show that people want to live in multi-generational communities. And that's why aging in place, as it's known, staying put in our own houses, can often be very appealing. You're around young families, and there's also options, the village model being the most notable, where neighbors are banding together to support themselves so they can extend that time of independence in their own homes.
Do the opportunities change based on demographics? We know that the polls also show us that non-whites are less prepared for retirement, have fewer resources to help their aging family members than white communities are. So, Susan, do the options get limited for certain communities and not for others?
I think that's absolutely true. And that having been said, you know, Beth made a comment about affordability, and I think one of my missions with the Greenhouse Project is to really make sure that it is not a model that's created just for those who have the resources to pay, but that it is a model that will be supported by the current funding reimbursement structures, such as Medicaid for skilled nursing. And so, you know, it is certainly incumbent upon us to really determine how we can gain efficiencies in this small house kind of model and really make it an affordable option when nursing care is needed.
I want to share this tweet. Bruce Scherer tweets to us, "My mom saw Dad in nursing home. No way she would ever go. Had her house totally set up for ground floor living, passed in her bed at 84. And Beth, there is an issue, I know in our family at least, there was an issue getting getting the proper care for aging relatives who didn't want to admit that they needed help. My grandmother, for example, wanted to remain independent while she couldn't be. She did need help, and that's help that she didn't want to admit she needed. How do you get past that, I don't want to say state of denial, but how do you get past to the reality of care needs?
Well, there's a couple things. One thing that I wish is that there were greenhouses in every community, because I think a lot of people's fear about long-term care is they think of it as going to prison or something. Seriously, they are terrified of it. I also have found some really interesting options, one by a doctor in Maine called Full Circle America, where he combines off-the-shelf technology, webcams, so that people can be monitored in their own homes, and he combines that with discrete kinds of help, a little bit of paid help, a little bit of family help, a little bit of neighbors, friends, church members, who together say, yeah, you know, I wouldn't mind helping Mrs. Jones stay in her own home mm-hmm. if I knew it wasn't going to overwhelm me. And I think we have to get really creative.
Yeah.
If you want to stay home, you have to plan ahead. You have to be creative, or you have to be rich, basically.
True enough. Beth Baker, author of the book, With a Little Help from Our Friends, Creating Community as We Grow Older. And Susan Ryan is Senior Director of the Greenhouse Project. Susan and Beth, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. So how ready do you feel for retirement? What age do you expect to retire? And do you have everything squared away for your later years, or are you still scrambling to reach a magic number? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.